Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with what I'd ask you to do, keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than... Now, tonight, my special guest is a psychotherapist and wellness specialist of 20 years of direct clinical service. His name is Dr. Brent Potter. He's director for the Society for Langian Studies. He's the author of numerous articles whose topics include innovative and effective mental health care models, analytical psychology, humanistic psychology, existential phenomenology, psychoanalysis, the psychotic register of the mind, character and personality disorders, chemical dependency, and child-adolescent mental health concerns. His first book, Elements of Self-Destruction, is out via Karnak Books, and he has three forthcoming books. Now, you can go to www.karnakbooks.com, and I'm going to ask him, rather than put in the product number and all of that, I'm going to ask him the best way to find it there and on Amazon. He also welcomes correspondence and can be contacted via Facebook at facebook.com/Dr. Brent Potter, P-O-T-T-E-R, or by email at brentpottermA@yahoo.com. And if you missed that, just go to freespiritbroadcasting.com, and you will find it there. So I would like to welcome Brent Potter, and I have my number one radio fan, who's going to be the future chief executive of freespiritbroadcasting.com. Jill is also in the studio tonight, and we may get her on the air because she always has interesting things to say. So without further ado, let me introduce Brent Potter, Ph.D. Brent, how are you tonight?
I'm doing excellent. It's great to be here. Thanks for the generous introduction.
Well, you were the one that wrote it. I just read it. But okay. You are most
well. Well, you pronounced phenomenology correctly, which is a pretty major accomplishment. Most people don't know how to pronounce that. So that's pretty cool.
Well, you know, I've experienced a little of phenomenology in my life, and as I alluded to earlier before we went on the air, there's been some phenomenology going on in my life that may require some psychoanalysis and some, you know, addressing mental health concerns. And since you also deal with chemical dependency, I might just pick your brain for the sake of the audience, and because I have a personal stake in it. Talk along the lines, Al-Anon, what can be done to somebody that's in a place of feeling powerlessness over being involved with somebody with what I would call a seeming addiction? Because my premise of my book, Occam's Razor Revisited, is that addiction is simply a symptom of a deeper distress, and therefore it's not exactly how most chemical dependency treatment centers would portray it, but let's go there later. What would you like to say to bring us up to speed with where you're at today?
Which part?
Well, you pick, and we'll go there.
Yeah, we can talk about addiction. We can talk about anything that you'd like, really. I'm open to it.
Well, why don't we start with addiction? That's kind of on my brain.
Yeah, go where the energy
what
is.
What are your
that
thoughts?
That seems to be the theme for today with people I've been talking to all day, especially how to be in a relationship with someone who is chemically dependent or really distressed.
Well, you know, an addiction can manifest in so many ways, so many compulsive behaviors. I have heard it said by Anthony DeMello that to be human is to be addicted. And by that, what he is saying is that we attach ourselves to external conditions and use those attachments as a means of trying to make ourselves feel better, when ultimately the only thing that can make ourselves feel better is ourselves or the source of our creation. Call it God, call it Jesus, Allah, Buddha, you name it, higher power. We need to practice self-love. So I believe if we are going to detach with love from these external things, including addictions, of which there are many. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, that just kind of goes straight. It kind of synchronistically goes straight to what I was thinking about anyway. You know, with my book that you mentioned, I talk a lot about destructiveness and the various forms of it, but where that leads me as I kind of follow the clues is to addiction is behind all of destructiveness. There's always an addictive process, and I end up arguing, I hope somewhat convincingly later in the book, that we're all addicts, in the sense that our whole culture is become very addicted in a lot of different ways. And it kind of struck me, I was reading the philosopher Heidegger talked about the world becoming an unworld in our contemporary age, where we're caught in a circularity of consumption for the sake of consumption. And it just struck me, kind of leapt off the page at that moment, that if that's the case of kind of the world of things today, then there's really no way to escape that. And it also kind of explains how the very specific kinds of addictions can crop up. It kind of like lays the framework for understanding not just an addiction to oil, gasoline, money. There's always so many different kinds, but also more specific ones, like in chemical dependency, for example.
Well, I hear you loud and clear. Now, here are some of my addictions, which many of my loyal listeners would be familiar with. I've been addicted to alcohol, to drugs, to sex, to toxic relationships, compulsive spending, cigarettes, and the list goes on. Now, I have literally, I'm not in recovery from these addictions except cigarettes, which I continue to struggle with, and that is a problem, because if I view something as a struggle instead of a challenge, I'm stuck. So I need to remind myself that it is simply a challenge I can overcome, and I have overcome every other addiction. I am healed. I am not in recovery. I am not an addict. Once an addict, not always an addict, I maintain. What do you think about that?
I agree. You know, we have enough information now to know from the research that chemical dependency is not a disease. For example, we've got a whole bunch of research on that. Probably the best and most recent are the ACE studies, the adverse childhood event studies. We know now basically what causes everything that's labeled as chemical dependency or abuse, and also the things that are labeled as mental health issues are basically the result of protracted developmental stress and or trauma. So they're not diseases.
I believe that mental and physical illness is simply a symptom, too, and that at the core, it has to do with this void that we experience, that we try to fill up with whatever, and when things are out of balance, we become physically sick, and for me, spirituality, taking care of myself at all levels, but for me, I take care of myself, my God self, first, and then everything else seems to fall into alignment. That works for me. Not everybody, and people are entitled to their different belief systems. But I'm finding that as I go along, I am attracting more and more people that share a similar beliefs, which I think is very interesting.
Well, I think it's implicit in a lot of the philosophy, even psychoanalysis and psychology that's out there now. For example, you know, I've thought about, you know, like with Heidegger, he's got capital B being, and then he has the human kind of being, which he calls Dasein. That's who we are. And we're inextricably linked to capital B being. And he talks about, he kind of traces a moment in history where capital B being becomes mistaken for being, for literal thing.
Ah.
And then
wow.
Also, you know, he talks about once that happens, that there's a certain way of thinking that sets in where we set to order these things in terms of usefulness to us and stockpiling them as reserves to be used. So basically, we start seeing all the things in the world is not related to capital B being. And I think you could probably fill in there if someone doesn't like Heidegger's word being. You know, some people say God, source, et cetera, et cetera. To see these
right.
things as everything is basically a thing to be used, ready at hand, then the next kind of indicated step is that everything is stripped of its meaning outside of that. So everything mm-hmm. in the world is here for me to use. And then also people fall into that. And I think that that is kind of at the root of the addictive process that's set out kind of
yes.
ontologically or globally. And then individual, sure enough, alcoholism, drug addiction, sex addiction, gambling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, become specific possibilities that can be taken
right.
up out of that.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to pick up on something that you were saying. Can you elaborate a little bit more on being? I'm very interested in that term.
Well, most of that would take like many books just to explain, but I think I can put it in a nutshell. So basically, Heidegger was a philosopher who is really interested in the question of being, capital B being, the meaning of being, and also some of the things that he goes on to elaborate about our relationship to being. So we're the human kind of being. We're always in relationship to capital B being. And how are
right.
we that way? And what does that mean? And so that was kind of his question that he tried to follow throughout his career. And then, of course, what happens if that goes awry? Or if we don't have, what about our relationship to it? What
yes.
kind of comportment do we have with it? Kind of shows, or it sets out how things appear in the world to us.
Well, it's all a question of perception, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. If everything in the world appears to humans or to me as a useful thing for me to consume, that's one thing. Or if I can look at things and see something of a sense of mystery in them
yes.
or something about them that is unto themselves, that they are something
yes.
outside of me, not just something for me to use, that they have their own agency, so
right.
to speak, or their own kind of being that's also related to me and capital B being.
Well, I love the word being.
Me too.
And I think of the other word, doing. We are not human doings, we are human beings, or as I would maintain, we're spiritual beings having a human experience who can have a spiritual experience, and it can be very mystical. And we can go to the very core of who we are when we open ourselves. And there are many, many different ways to get there. It's important to be open-minded and honest and willing to go to any length, as they say in 12-step programs. And I have found that gratitude is one of the main keys to experience, to experiencing abundance. And, of course, love is the glue that holds it all together. But generally speaking, from my perspective, it is important for me to stay aligned with all things positive. I need to feel safe. And for instance, as I was saying to Brent earlier, alluding to this fact, I was not in a place where I was feeling very safe, and we can get into that later. But I think it is so important to just be and recognize that we are here for a reason. And when you talked about people, it made me think of something else they talk about in 12-step programs, and that is people, places, and things. And these are the very things that we become attached to. However, if we open ourselves to experiencing people, places, and things, then we can grow and be transformed as a result of our exposure through being open-minded. What do you think about that?
Agreed. You know, I think that if we're in relationship to something and can experience it in mystery or in its unknownness, I think that that's kind of, I was thinking about this the other day, I think that the word mystic in its best possible way, and by that I don't necessarily mean New Age, religious, etc., but just in the sense of referring to the or contemplating upon kind of the unknown dimension of life, like we really don't know. And there are so many, it's almost like psychology is kind of based upon that. I mean, from Freud through Jung to Bion, and even in phenomenology with Heidegger, it's almost like a constant reflection upon the unknown and how we are in the unknown. I can be in the unknown in a place of anxiety, I don't know, or depression, like I feel sad that I don't know, can't do anything about it, kind of helpless. And I think that even psychotic states of mind can be seen as one way, one strategy, radical strategy of being in the unknown. Or we can be in a place of faith.
Well, you know, it's interesting when I heard you use the I feel sad statement. That, to me, I'd like to pick apart, because when I feel a certain way, in a sense, I'm becoming a victim to my feelings. I want to take charge of them and recognize it's simply part of my human experience. And this is a new insight that's occurred to me. Yes, I may feel a certain way, but it's more empowering for me to experience and let it go. And then I can move on to the next best thought, action, or feeling. And I believe what Esther Hicks says, who channels Abraham, and what Joseph Campbell, author of The Power of Myth, says, and that is follow your bliss, or do not allow anything to take you from consistent moments of joy. And it is possible, folks, to remain in that place. And even though I have been challenged, and I may choose to talk about this later, recently, with some very what would have been extremely disturbing experiences in my past, they have been blips on the radar because I have chosen to make lemonade out of lemons and embrace the experience as part of the learning curve, as if I'm taking a graduate course, and it's cost me dearly financially, but I consider that I have been investing in my education.
Or being credentialed by being. You know, I think the struggles is kind of just a way of being credentialed, given the experience that we need to move on to what's next.
What do you think are the most effective mental health care models?
Well, I just really quick, I wanted to say something about affective reality that you refer to, emotions. I think that it's not an either-or thing, like either I control my emotions and I'm in charge of them, or I don't control, and I'm not suggesting that you were implying that, but I think it's kind of a both-and thing, where I think we find ourselves in moods. I think that moods kind of come over us, like we find ourselves there, and there it's important to recognize it and then contemplate it or engage it. But I would want to relativize the ego a little bit, just so that it's not like it's in charge and certain emotions are bad and certain ones are good. You know, it's good to experience the full range of affective life, but definitely to not totally be in charge of them, and also, of course, not to totally let emotions just dictate, you know, what we do.
Well, I like what you said about it not being necessarily good or bad, because ultimately it's all for our good as part of our experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like people will make a judgment and say this is right or wrong, but ultimately if it's part of our experience and we learn and grow from it, then it's all right. It's all good, and it's better than good.
Right. And a lot of the ways to joy, somewhat paradoxically or at least ironically, are through suffering and pain. It's usually through a great deal of pain and suffering. It's kind of like they're the greatest teachers. And I'm not saying go pursue those or to stay there, but they tend to be the greatest teachers, because then usually there's what the Greeks used to call a metanoia process, a kind of working through, reaching wholeness, reaching completion, kind of change of mind or change of perception that lands in joy. And I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect, you know, joy, serenity, abundance, and all those things is where the soul rests. That's kind of the resting rate of the soul. But sometimes it takes some suffering to get there.
Absolutely. And the greater the suffering, the greater the capacity for joy or ecstasy is. And, you know, it's just amazing how things work at a spiritual level and the emotional dynamics of human experience in terms of shape, our learning curve, our growth potential. It's just amazing. Now, I've suffered terribly in my past. I've attempted suicide many times and gone into addictions and so on and so forth, you know, circumstances that have only brought me to my today where my joy is beyond measure and it keeps getting greater and greater with each passing day.
Yeah, Michael Ligon, one of my kind of a mentor person in my life, he talks about sometimes that if the psyche stays with an experience or an affect long enough, that it kind of perforates the psyche. It kind of creating kind of a wormhole, if you will, in the psyche where you're kind of rocketed to another sort of existential space that you would have never arrived to had you not had that extreme protracted state of stress or some emotion or something like that. And I've seen that a lot. I've seen that a lot where it's like if you stick with something long enough, it flips into its opposite. So it's interesting.
It is. Now, you talked a little bit a while ago about ego. I'd like to go there for a moment, if you will, and talk about ego versus spirit, or perhaps fear versus love, and also examine what parts of the ego are healthy from a human perspective and what parts are dysfunctional. Would you speak to that?
Oh, wow, that's a lot. Yeah, so the ego, the way that I tend to conceptualize the ego is just the way kind of Freud did. It's the sense that I am, that I experience myself to be. And I don't get on the New Age bandwagon where the ego is evil and is to be obliterated. The ego really does serve a purpose. You know, people who have a completely obliterated ego are at risk of being diagnosed schizophrenic or something like that, where the mind is just very fragmented and it feels like the little bit of the ego that's left is always being inundated and demolished almost perpetually. So the ego serves an important role. Again, this isn't like either or, it's kind of both and. It's the ego is necessary, and it's necessary in development to learn who I am versus who others are and things like that. And so spirit is the second thing you were asking about. I mean, I don't know about spirit. I kind of think that the word spirituality, I kind of wish we had a better word for it. I mean, I know what people mean when they refer to it, but spirit, if you look at like Greek mythology or Greek antiquity, their word spirit actually meant something like breath, air, something like that, and it represents kind of the masculine. It was kind of the masculine principle in things in contrast to soul, which of course is important, I hope, to some of us in psychology, because their word for it was psuche or psyche. And, you know, so psuche, like psychology, psychotherapy, psychiatry. So soul was more of the feminine principle in things. And so when people say spirituality, I understand what they mean, and I understand what people mean when they say spirit, but spirit and soul are actually different. You know, soul is a feminine principle. It's more of what mediates experiences. James Hillman used to say it's what translates events into experiences, whereas spirit is more masculine principle. It's more transcendent. You know, it's more upward lifting, inspiring. So they're a little bit different principles. And then, you know, where things go awry or where what is unhealthy or healthy, I'm not sure I can say, but, you know, some of these things can lead to extreme states of emotion, thought, and things like that that are distressing to the person. And once it becomes distressing to the person, then that, generally speaking, is what I consider kind of a measure of health. Basically, I'm using what other people perceive themselves to be, if they're centered, healthy, well, successful, as they define those things for themselves, then I consider that to be true. But I don't think that there's any real objective standard that I'm aware of like this person's
well,
healthy
that
and that
all
person's
seems
not.
To come
or,
back to the love principle, I would say. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I was getting at when I talked about spirit, and I was very interested in how you delineated spirit versus soul, the masculine and the feminine, and we could go on and on about that.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's amazing how many people do not embrace the total aspects of self and therefore cut
right.
themselves off, you know, and become left-brained, right-brained, whatever. But when we talk about love, to me, that, again, comes to a positive, and the opposite of love is fear. I've heard it said that anything that is not love is fear. Therefore, any negative-seeming emotion is, in a sense, fear-based. And, again, that's something that we could talk about forever. But I just am very impressed with what you talk about with soul and how you align that with psyche. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Well, yeah, I didn't think of that at all. That's the Greek word comes from that. Soul for them was something that was terribly important. So the thread of it kind of runs through Freud, and then it runs Jung, really amplified
yes.
that. Anyone who's familiar with Jungian stuff, yeah. So when he talks about anima, that's just Latin for soul.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have just as easily said psyche. And then that's picked up with Joseph Campbell, and it's really amplified in James Hillman, the importance of soul.
I'm familiar with the name, but not of his work. What are some of the premises of his work?
Oh, James Hillman? He was kind of one of the main founders of archetypal psychology. It was a psychology that really focuses upon soul and image.
Oh.
And his,
okay.
You would really enjoy his work. He was a teacher that I had at one time, and I was blessed to have a few conversations with him. I learned quite a bit.
Hmm.
He wrote Revisioning Psychology, which is an excellent book. Anima,
mm-hmm.
An Anatomy of a Personified Notion is another excellent book. Dream in the Underworld is another great one. So, yeah, I'm a big fan. He makes many appearances in my writing.
Hmm. Well, I feel like I have visited the underworld lately. I even experienced some psychosis, and I haven't experienced that in years. Let's talk a little bit about your first book, Elements of Self-Destruction, and then maybe get more into the chemical dependency, and it sounds like that also addresses that area.
Yes, absolutely.
Please
All right,
tell us
well,
about your book.
Sure. So in Elements of Self-Destruction, that started out as my dissertation. It's basically a revised version of my dissertation. And at the time, I was really digging into the writing of my dissertation. I was studying for comps, the written, the oral ones there in school. And so I had to read a lot of the DSM and have a lot of that just ready to go when I was asked questions or had to take the test. So I was just thinking to myself, I was like, well, what is, like, all of these diagnoses, what do they boil down to? Like, if there was a characteristic in these or two, what would those be? And long story short, I thought, well, they all have the quality of being kind of obsessive and kind of compulsive, whether it's any of them. They're kind of like, I have to do this, and I'm compelled to repeat it again. They seem to have those two qualities. And then I thought about, so it was like my first clue. And then I was thinking about it more, and I was like, well, that doesn't quite work because there are all kinds of things that everyone does. They're kind of obsessive and compulsive. I mean, if you've ever tried writing a book, that's a pretty obsessive-compulsive activity.
I've written two of them, and some of them I've written in as 4 weeks. Talk about compulsive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have one author that wrote that many books in a year.
Yeah. So it's and a lot of those behaviors are applauded. Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
If someone applies that ethic – something like that to business, it tends to be applauded, or to book writing, that's applauded, right. Or going and getting a graduate degree, that's applauded. And so I was like, well, I think those two qualities are there, but I don't think that goes far enough. And then that's when it occurred to me, oh, destructiveness has to be a part of it. It has to be self-destructive in some way, or else it's not really diagnosable by their standards. So that led me to destructiveness, and then that's my book just takes off to kind of explore that in history and in all the different schools of psychology, psychoanalysis, and then I kind of move on from there.
Well, the thing I wanted to say about compulsions, and here we can walk a black and white line that involves judgment, which is so important to stay away from, I believe. There healthy and unhealthy compulsions. For example, writing my books is my passion, and so I feel compelled to write them, and that's healthy, but my compulsive sexual behavior was extremely dysfunctional, extremely unhealthy, degrading, shameful, etc., and it caused me great pain. I attempted suicide over it, and so, you know, it is just amazing that we can fall victim or prey to judgment, as an example. And, you know, I felt compelled to say that. Let's talk some more about your book. What else do you have to say?
Well, no, that fits right into it in a lot of different ways, actually, because, you know, a compulsion, so it's like when is a compulsion good or when is it bad? And what do we mean by good and bad? I mean, a compulsion becomes distressing usually to someone when it limits their freedom. When it starts to take away their freedom, then it becomes something that, you know, usually isn't described as great by someone. And, you know, the other area where, you know, because there are other avenues where our freedom is limited, but it's still kind of okay. But I think this might be kind of a simple way to think about it, but I think it's kind of a good rule of thumb that, like, passion and addiction are two sides of the flip, the same coin. They're just two sides of the same coin. And so, you know, someone can be passionately driven to do something, and that's a little obsessive and compulsive, but it's a passion. It's something that is a part of one's character, their faith, their necessity, their truth, to use old kind of Greek way of looking at it. But whereas that same energy inverted is an addiction. And addiction is, by definition, destructive in one or more ways.
Well,
and so that's where the freedom is limited. That's where there are lots of consequences qualitatively, usually quantitatively, too. And so, but it's the same energy. They're very close to each other. So it can move back and forth, too. It's a moving system. So it can move back and forth in between passion, addiction, 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 passion, 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 you know, and it can kind of evolve that way over time, or someone can stay stuck more or less on one side or the other.
I'd like to back up to that important word I heard you use two or three times, and that is freedom. Now, this country was supposedly founded on freedom. How free do we feel today, folks? Now, don't answer that. Just think about it. And then think about freedom in the world and where it exists and doesn't exist. And then think about freedom of the spirit or the soul or the freedom to love, to choose love, the freedom to make choices, period. I mean, freedom is what I yearn for. And when I'm free, I can experience whatever I want to. And why would I choose to experience anything that is not positive? It makes no sense. What do you think about that?
Well, passion is freedom in the sense that it's our character unfolding relative to our calling, and there's a freedom in that because we're being who we were meant to be, whereas addiction, and to get back to what I said, kind of a riff off Heidegger about how the world is in a kind of addictive phase or something right now where everything is a thing to be used, consumed, eaten, put it in your gas tank, et cetera. It's like disposable planet. You know, addiction by definition is chains on us. If the world is in that state of affairs, then clearly it has impact in the realm of the individual and in terms of nations and in terms of all of these things that our freedom existentially, as in fundamentally speaking, is altered drastically. And so then on the individual level, it's much harder to take up a free range of freedom possibilities when they're restricted to begin with. Like our way of looking at the world is restricted, and so our individual freedom is restricted, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And it made me, as you were talking, I was thinking of the word control,
right,
which a lot of people try to do when they're in addictions. They try to control it, and then they become so frustrated because they can't control it. It is beyond control. I like the word take charge better. I like the word empower better than enable. And I think that it is so, I don't think, I believe and know it is so important to take charge. I am the master of my fate, the captain of my destiny. If I do not take that perspective, I am once again falling into the victim trap. And then I lose my freedom.
Right. So there's kind of a spectrum there, I think, of like, to use kind of your word, so like victim on the one hand, and then just like rugged individualism on the other. It's just me.
Yeah.
You know, and we're somewhere in between. Like a real good spiritual awareness, I think, of our sense of power has to do with that power and volition in relationship. So Dasein, the human kind of being, is individualized expression. It's a kind of capital B being. It's one version of being. And then me within that, I am an individualized expression of capital B being. So there's nothing wrong in the passionate unfoldment of my character within that and within the world, so long as it's relativized, so long as it's relative to my community, to the people in my life, and ultimately to capital B being, then I think that that is a very positive expression of one's agency in the world, whereas addiction is the shadow side of that. It's everything that that is not. It's out of relationship. It's anti-thinking, anti-feeling, and it kind of overcompensates, if you will, with fantasies of power and control. Addiction is always involved in a fantasy of power and control, while all the while losing any semblance of authentic power or agency in the world or with themselves.
Well, now you have got me thinking along a couple of other lines, as if you have that power over me, and I'm going to go from the word B being to P for power. I just gave my power away in that statement, folks. if you caught it. What I would like to do is examine the word power and where that comes from. Now, ultimately, I believe it comes from God or source, universe, universes, whatever you want to call it, that power greater than ourselves, referred to in 12-step programs as higher power, because not religious programs, they're quote-unquote spiritual programs, which are designed for people of all faith traditions, including atheists, who sometimes find them quite workable, if they can find a power greater than themselves, such as the group, for example, or the collective wisdom, the collective consciousness. So what does power mean to you? And then I had another thought, and I have lost it temporarily, but maybe it'll return to me.
So, power. I don't think power is, it's one word, but I don't think it's one thing. And it's definitely referred to throughout, like, the history of psychology, going back through psychoanalysis, even before Freud. And I talk a little bit about this in my book. He definitely picks up on Nietzsche's will to power. That was like one of Nietzsche's central themes. Eternal return and the will to power are two of his central things. And of course, Alfred Adler picked up on that too and had his own variation of it. But power, I mean, a brief way to put it is that, if you look at the history of psychology, let's say, so that starts with psychoanalysis. You got Freud, and Freud basically says you have your ego, and then there's the unconscious. And the unconscious is this vast, vast unknown that this little ego is in relation to, as if the ego is like a little expression of the unknown. And then you move to Jung, and Jung has the capital S self, and the small s self. Edward Edinger outlines this, the ego self axis. And so it's kind of like this little self or the little ego is an individualized expression of self. And that moves, you can look at Wilfred Bion. He talks about capital O, which is ultimate unknown, unknowable processes. And we've got this little ego in relationship to that. It's like an individual. And these people are all writing at roughly the same time. So if you don't like psychology, you don't like psychoanalysis, then you can set that aside and then look over to existential phenomenology. At the same time, these people, roughly speaking, were writing. Heidegger is talking about sign and Dasein, capital B being, and its expression, the human kind of being. And then within that, individuals are individualized expressions, or individualizing is probably better, expressions of capital B being and Dasein. And then if you don't like
there
that, writing at the same time are the New Thought people. And the New Thought people were writing in America, again, at roughly the same time. What did they say? They said, well, there's creation out there, or source, they called it, and we have access to that. We have access to those possibilities of relatedness, the way they're connected is thinking. Heidegger says something similar. So all of these thinkers, and I could go on, there's Hegel, his notion of Geist, Zeitgeist moving through spirit, moving through time. All of the great luminaries seem to suggest something like that. Or, I mean, really simplistically, the question could be put, what are you plugged into? What is it that is greater than us? And for people who, really struggle with understanding that there's anything larger than themselves that they're connected to inextricably, sometimes I'll just say to them, what about the life that's living you? And I don't just mean the complex synthesis of B vitamins and proteins and things like that. It's like, what is it that lives you? What is the life that lives you?
Wow.
And I think
for
people who don't have, like, are unwilling to understand that there's anything outside of themselves, it's just them versus the cold, harsh, dead world out there of dead matter and this and that, there's something that animates. What is the life that lives you? That seems to be a way to frame it, that they go, oh, okay, there's something. You know, what is that? And then just open it up and leave it open. It's not a math question, like 2 + 2 = 4. It's like an open question. Just contemplate, that. But the whole tradition, psychology, philosophy, New Thought, all emerging at roughly the same. Oh, and you can go back further to cultures of antiquity, also had the same sense of things. There's a very rich area. And so power, in my mind, anyway, is like, what is that that we're connected to inextricably? Like, there's no one thing added on to another. We're expressions of it. And then what is our relationship to that? We can have different relationships to that. And that, I think, is what kind of defines power or lack of power,
You have elicited a proliferation of thoughts and ideas within me. I'd like to go back to power or creativity or creator for a minute. Now, Esther Hicks, again, to bring up her name, talks about co-creating. However, I maintain that we are all connected to Source, therefore we are all creators. More powerful than co-creator, we are individualized expressions of the ultimate source of our beings, I say at the end of every show. And I also want to get into shadow and light to examine paradoxes, because light always overcomes shadow, but we all have this shadow side of ourselves that we need to embrace and let go of if we're going to move into the light. And so many people live in fear and are afraid to face themselves, and then they never truly know who they are. What do you think about that?
Well, shadow, strictly speaking, at least in Jungian psychology, shadow is oftentimes, it's unfortunate, oftentimes these days some Jungian thinkers equate shadow with evil. A more ontological perspective, Jung, when he talks about shadow, he says it has a direct relationship to persona, and it's simply what is in the unknown. The shadow is the unknown, dimensions of psychic reality. And so the shadow, I don't think it's something to, that, or even if we could, that it's ever something to confront, kill, completely integrate. There's always a shadow to every activity that we do, just without any kind of moralism, like good, bad, right, wrong. Any possibility that we take up, we're automatically not taking up quite a number of other possibilities. So shadow, where it's important is that our relation, again, it's about relationship. It's like, what's our relationship to shadow? It's about propriety in the sense that if I'm too close to my shadow, like it really informs a lot of my thinking and acting and emotion. If I'm too identified with the shadow, that can become problematic. Or if I'm so divorced from my shadow that it operates like an autonomous personality within the mind, that can also be really problematic. So it's a matter of staying, knowing our shadow, being in an appropriate relationship with it, where appropriate means kind of the right kind of distance or the right kind of way to be with it.
I haven't disagreed with a single thing that you've said during this interview, which is another amazing thing. I would like to bring on a caller by the name of Jill, who I referred to earlier. I'm sure she would love to pick your brain because we've covered a lot of terrain that Jill and I have discussed individually. She's a very astute person. She's psychic. She's very wise. She's led a life that's been filled with a lot of pain, the suffering that you referred to, which has led to her joy. So I'm going to bring Joy on, Jill on the line.
Great.
Jill, hello.
Hello.
Hi,
Jill,
there.
Nice to meet
How
you.
Are you?
Good. I would like to ask about narcissism,
Ooh.
Which runs rampant in my family, and how do people become narcissistic? What happens? And personality disorders. How do people end up with a personality disorder?
All right. Well, I just wrote a book, co-authored a book on borderline personality disorder, so your questions are awesome. They're pressuring my mind.
Thank you.
So, yeah, right. Well,
yeah.
Okay, personality disorders. So where do personality disorders come from? As I mentioned earlier, basically, we're able to – we have enough evidence. Gabor Mate bravely says, and I agree with him, that we don't even need any more research on this. Things that are later labeled as mental health disorders and or chemical dependency and, as a kind of side notation, a number of physical health issues are related to developmental stress and or trauma. So you can have protracted stress developmentally, that is early on in life, and that can later affect something that would be labeled as one of those things I just mentioned. Or you can have trauma, and that can do that, or you can have some combination therein. So stress and trauma going together, of course, increases the likelihood of one or more of those things. So that is what is generates what today would be labeled as an access to or personality disorder. As far as personality disorders go, there are three broad criterion that are used in the diagnostic manual, which I don't believe in psychiatric labels at all, really. But those are tenuous.
I don't either.
Adaptive.
I think they're very
deceptive
and limiting. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm against them for a variety of different reasons I won't get into right this second. But they're tenuous stability, adaptive inflexibility, and fostering vicious cycles, any one of which will put the clinician on kind of the hot trail for making an access to diagnosis. So I bring those up not because I believe in psychiatric labels at all, but what those kind of imply are certain characterological or personality things in relationship. So access to disorders tend to be, although aren't always, have to do with someone in relationship or chaotic relationships and also chaotic emotion. Do you want to know about narcissism in particular? Is that what you're asking about?
Yes, I would. And what do you do with narcissistic people and survive with them?
Well, I like to, I don't use the psychiatric labels that much, but I know what you're referring to. So narcissism isn't, again, like one thing. It's a lot of different things, and it can have a lot of different kind of manifestations. Usually, I think what someone means with narcissism is like extreme self-centeredness, or I think kind of a constant pattern of self-centeredness and also like delusions of grandeur almost, or high expectations of things that they're going to do or are doing, exaggerated things like that. So narcissism, again, I don't use the psychiatric label, but they're, when selfishness becomes a problem for others, that's usually what's labeled as narcissistic. What to do with them, I mean, I don't know. I don't really think of psychotherapy as something that's done to someone, and so I don't, I really base it upon whether someone themselves, what they're reporting is being distressing.
Hmm.
That makes sense. So is your question more about, like, you know someone, or if you knew someone who is very self-centered and kind of grandiose in some ways, or...
I, like, in my family, both of my sisters, my mother, are narcissistic, and it runs rampant on my mother's side of the family. And also along with that, there's no empathy. So how do you survive a family full of narcissists with no empathy?
Well, I would tend to think about that as someone or some people who had probably had a lot of trauma or stress in their background, and I try to think of it as compassionately as possible and also kind of setting boundaries on my end in terms of my wellness and my, you know, health and things like that as I consider those things for myself. But basically, I would consider anything that others would label as access to as someone who's really suffering. And it's probably had a background of some serious distress.
That's interesting. If I can jump in for a minute, I'm thinking about this person that I've been involved with who I perceive and has mentioned, without going into details, tremendous suffering. And he got back into drug addiction because he was suffering. He lost his best friend, and he'd had years of recovery under his belt and chose to self-medicate, which, you know, it's possible to do that without becoming addicted. However, it's a real trap for somebody
right.
that has that past, as it has been for me. So I'm just wondering, when I got involved with this person, I took on that suffering because I'm a compassionate person. But then what happened is then I allowed myself to be sucked into his world, which was a very dark world. It was a world filled with self-destructiveness, and it became self-destructive to me at many levels, psychically, emotionally, and I even allowed myself to do something I hadn't done in 26 years. I smoked cocaine, and it was laced with, among other things, LSD, and I had a psychotic break, broke every dish in the house, and kicked the dog. Yeah, and then it was a nightmare. But what followed within minutes of that is the police arrived at my doorstep. Somebody had called them and said that I was a drug addict and alcoholic, a danger to myself and others. I was committed to a mental hospital for 8 days. How do you like that?
Oh, man.
Yeah. Now, I have been in one once before when I attempted suicide. And I have had this bipolar disorder attached to me, but I believe that basically that evolved out of addiction, coming in and out, cycling in and out of addiction, shame, despair, suffering, elation, et cetera. I don't like labels, and I do not like addiction as a label. I don't like physical disease as a label. I believe it all comes down to symptom of deeper distress, and I think about this trauma that you referred to. I'm a victim of trauma. I was molested as a child. I was raped as a child. And I allowed myself to play victim for many years because I blamed myself for that, as many rape victims do, or victims of abuse. Today, I will not be a victim to anyone. However, I fell into that trap. And it was so easy to do in spite of what I knew about myself, about God, about recovery. I did it. I take total responsibility for everything that happened, everything. It was all my seeming fault. And, you know, ultimately, we're all responsible for our own fate, if you will have, if you want to use that word. But one of the things I'm wondering, because I was in such a bad-seeming place when this interview began, I was wondering how I would do it, and I challenged myself to a place of strength. I had gotten a text at a 12-step meeting I chose to go to for more strength after meeting with the sponsor. I got a text from this fellow who said, please come get me. I need you. And in that moment when I got the text, it was like, oh, my God, I've got to save him. I can't save him. Only God can save him. But what do you say to somebody that's in that trap? I mean, I extricated myself. I took some steps to protect myself and make myself feel safe. But the feelings were feeling. But what do you say to somebody that's locked in a toxic relationship, that's locked in a relationship with an addict? What steps can they take to extricate themselves from the trap?
Well, I think that there is a lot there. So where I would almost start a little bit broader, just in the sense, but I'll get exactly to what you're saying, a little bit broader with, you know, when I talk about addiction as a fundamental feature of our contemporary world, I do mean that. And so I think that there is a little bit, if it's contextualized that way, we can understand our various forms of distress, substance abuse and otherwise, as something that is larger than us, that's happening as a part of a more like global pathology, if you will. So it's not something in contrast to the sort of medical model that says that it is a chemically imbalanced or otherwise malfunctioning brain organ in your head. It's not something that exists within us.
Could you refer to that as unconsciousness, perhaps?
Well, we are the unconscious of the world in some ways. We act it out. And so I think that from a, again, I know I'm speaking a little bit more broadly than what you were asking, but I think broadly speaking, when it's contextualized that way, so many forms of our distress are not the product of ourselves, of like somehow it occurs in our brain organ, that we are able to pick up or not pick up various forms of distress by the possibilities disclosed to us by society, our contemporary society. So then within that, we're affected. And then once we're affected, you know, one way to frame it is that, as you know, we were talking about before, is so we're in a circumstance, whatever that may be. It's a good time to contemplate what are my actions within this relationship, what are my actions in my present predicament? Are they a function of faith? And when I say faith, I am not equating that with religion. It may include religion for some people, but actually it doesn't need to. Am I having faith in myself? Faith in whatever I consider my broader source, whatever that may be? Do I have faith in that? Do I have faith in the process? Do I have faith in some of the beliefs that I have that are fundamental to the world? Or if I'm not in faith, then in the place of that are anti-faith strategies, worry, fear, anger, resentment, impulsiveness. The list goes on ad infinitum. Those are all basically ways of not being in faith. There's something that we're in. We're in a form of distress, such as the one you're describing, where we're in the unknown. And being in the unknown is what produces anxiety and things like that. So I think it's a good, what I tend to ask people if they're willing is to consider, you know, what are the things that you believe in? And then is faith a part of that, or is there kind of anti-faith stuff going on? And anti-faith stuff usually takes on, underneath it, there's usually anger and fear. And I don't mean literally angry, like, oh, I'm going to do whatever, or yelling, or whatever. But underneath somewhere, like what's my real fear? Usually that I'm not getting my way. Or my anger is a defense against something else that I'm afraid of. So I'm not afraid. I'm propping myself up with the affect of anger. Anger kind of shores us up, as does rage. So those things. And then the other thing that I invite people to think about sometimes is, because everyone wants to know, how do I manage that? How do I get? Well, one is by knowing that it's not entirely in your brain, that you're not producing it. Secondly, or that it's the product of a chemically imbalanced brain organ or something. You know, secondly, that it's a broader issue. You know, secondly, you know, what is your stance or your posture in your present circumstance, and what's that based on? And just facing that, is it fear, is it anger, is it faith, what is it? Or maybe a combination of those things, what is that? And then thirdly, I find that for the real practical stuff, it's a matter of being of service somehow. And I know that that's kind of tricky when the sort of dynamics that you're talking about are going on, because where am I being of service and where am I like rushing in and rescuing? But there are ways of genuinely sort of doing something that is maybe a random act of kindness. It dials us, it gets us outside of ourselves, and it dials us into community. So like someone who doesn't know a lot of context to the situation or my present distress, maybe I will help that person. Maybe it's a phone call to a friend I haven't spoken to a while. Maybe it's someone who can't pay for something. Maybe I give them just a friendly phone call and say, I understand, you know, you're not ready to and can't really pay for a lot of services. I just wanted to let you know that I care. And then I'm, you know, I can talk to you just in a friendly kind of manner for a brief time. Maybe that will help. And I can refer you to some resources you may not know about. And it doesn't have to even be any of that. It can be something else that's kind. Maybe kindness to animals. Maybe it's, but do you see what I mean? Something that's different than our situation, which we're kind of locked into. So it's radically different. And it's also somehow of some kind of service that gets us out of ourselves, helps someone else, and kind of dials us into community a little bit more, so we're not kind of locked up in that emotional state or that kind of distress.
What it speaks to me of is connection. And, you know, you speak about service and how amazing it can be if you're in a place of distress. To reach out and be of service to somebody else takes your mind off your own problems. It works for me. My mother told me to do that as a kid, and I resisted, you know, fell further into the hole. But to me, ultimately, it's about connection. We are not in this alone. When we're of service to another person, we are connected to that person. We're connected to source energy or God, if you believe in that. Taking us to a place of faith, alignment, inner knowing, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it said that song, No Man is an Island, or, you know, let's not be sexist, no person is an island. If I isolate, I fall into a world of just nothingness. And when I reach out, as you say, reach out to a friend, play with a pet, do something that takes me outside of myself, then I'm connected. What do you think about that?
Yes, that's kind of what, that's the spirit of what I'm getting at, is, that's it. And also, you know, I think that there's a difference between, like, rushing in and rescuing, which can be kind of a protracted and potentially unhealthy engagement, versus like an act of kindness, which is a single, like, and I, you know, with someone who doesn't know a lot about our context. So we're not, they don't know like the extent of whatever it is, and we're just going to do something nice maybe for a stranger or maybe for a waiter or waitress or for an animal somewhere or something along those lines, you know.
And with expecting
that
nothing
really
in return. If we expect
right.
something in return, then we're attaching a condition or we're attaching again. You
and
know,
it's a useful thing for me. It's another thing that falls into that kind of global addiction. Then it's
well,
a useful thing for me, right, if I do that. So not asking for anything in return, just kind of a random act of goodness.
And it brings us back to this whole spiritual principle of when you give, you receive. You know, and it could be looked at as centered, but it's just amazing because when I give something of myself or give a gift, it brings me great joy, and my joy is multiplied. You know, there's so many things that one can do to get out of oneself. Jill, would you like to jump in?
I think maybe it should be explained a little more, saving, enabling, to be more selective on who you give to and who you don't.
Oh, yeah. What would you
Fred,
like to
do
say?
Do you have
Fred?
Any comment?
Oh, sure. Right. So enabling is a term that's usually picked up in 12-step oriented groups. I'm guessing that is more Al-Anon. And so enabling, I think, refers to the process of supporting someone through an act of addiction of one kind or another to the person's detriment. So basically you're supporting them and their ongoing form of distress. And so ultimately that can be pretty destructive actually to pretty much everyone involved because you're supporting the pathology or their non-wellness going on. So that's enabling. And I think, but that's kind of you're alluding to a really good point, which is that it's not always sort of black and white where something is actually helping and then where someone's enabling someone. So the way I tried to frame that was in terms of almost like a random act of kindness to a stranger or something like that, where it's good for the person, the stranger, but it's also helping one get out of him or herself. And so a brief act of kindness like that would be very different than enabling, which by definition is like an ongoing process, typically.
Hmm.
But there was one other word you mentioned. I didn't...
Go ahead.
Saving someone, enabling.
Right. Yeah, I use the word rescue, but I think saving...
Rescue is good.
Yeah, saving is just as fine, too. So rescuing, you know, rescuing is... That's been kind of the topic of conversation lately. So rescuing is more like there's a relationship. I'm trying to think of a typical like example. So there's a relationship, and let's say one of the partners is an addict. Or if not an addict, you know, this can go into other realms. Maybe there's some other vulnerability that the person has. And then the other partner comes in and sees this and says, I'm Superman, I can fix this. My project.
What about
is
going global
and that
from
also,
that?
You know.
I'm thinking a little bit larger now. When we talk about rescue, I'm thinking about what this country tends to do when there's conflicts in other part of the world. We try to rescue them, and we stick our noses in, and then we get involved in wars. I mean, it can be taken to such catastrophic dimensions when
has
we
been.
Enable or rescue or try to save the world.
Yeah, it has been taken to very catastrophic dimensions in today, in today's world. Absolutely, it has. And that's where I get, you know, I'm really glad you brought that up because one of the things I try to emphasize, hopefully in my writing as well as in my discussions with people is that, you know, how do we go about things? I really think that it's a matter of the individual taking care of him or herself in a non-self-centered kind of way. Because if I am, by my definition, well, healthy, successful, centered, and I choose those words because they have kind of a self-evident meaning to them. If you ask someone if they're centered, they know pretty much automatically, or if they're well that day or So that's why I choose. But until we are those things, then it really makes no sense to go out and to try and be of use to others in the world, because what really happens is we're taking our quasi-centeredness or non-centeredness or wellness or whatever word out into the world and then prescribing to others how they should be or how they should manage themselves. And then I think that links in brilliantly to your global point, which is that, you know, perhaps the same advice could be applied not just to individuals, but to communities, to nations, to things, organizations, to things like that. Are you
in order?
Are you well? Are you healthy? And then maybe you can go and be of service to others.
You know, I like the word centered. In order to be centered, I have to be present to the moment.
Correct.
And presence is so important. I mean, that can go to the nth level. Again, that can come to God. For example, one, we are all one. Ultimately, we are one with our Creator or whatever you want to call it. And again, that comes to connection to Source, connection to each other. But it is so important to remain present and aware. And you talked about taking care of yourself. I mean, that's what sponsors in 12-step programs have told me is the ultimate goal of recovery. And I thought to myself, really? I thought it was not to pick up a drink. Well, isn't that taking care of yourself? But it transcends to so many different areas. And I have to, going back to what I said earlier, I have to remain aware and take care of myself at all levels, heart, mind, body, and soul.
And that's where power is, to link back to your previous thing, because it has to do with connection, again, to the larger, whatever one wants to call that. That's where power is, and that's also where centeredness, wellness, and all of that resides in a non-self-centered, that is, not everything is here for me, a non-self-centered kind of way. And so it's paradoxical, as Joy points out. You know, these lines are not always black and white. There are many shades in between, and it's really hard sometimes. And I, you know, another dimension to talk about at some point would be forgiveness. You know, Emmett Fox always talked about the importance of forgiveness, and he said the hardest thing that we can do is to forgive ourselves. And that's
How do we do that? Because I have a struggle with that.
I think he was right. I mean, I've found that self-forgiveness is so challenging. Like, whereas we would forgive many things in others, even egregious things, the slightest things in ourselves, we have the hardest time letting go of or forgiving in ourselves. So you know, I think that gets back to connection. You know, are we connected? Mm-hmm. Are we dialed in to that? And then do we have faith in those things? Because if we're dialed into those things and we have faith, we're a part of community, we're of service, then self-forgiveness is almost comes along organically.
Well, you know, a very wise woman suggested another word instead of forgiveness, which is release. To me, forgiveness, I look at that with religious background implying sin or shame or whatever, which to me is simply being human. And when I think in terms of forgiving, I'm thinking of forgiving a sin which casts a judgment on something. Instead, why not just release whatever it's distressing me? Why not release the past, burn the bridges that don't serve me anymore, and just let go?
It's, you know, whatever word works for one. For me personally, the word release implies, again, ego. And ego releases. Something else forgives. You see, if something is lifted for me or I am forgiven, and again, all of these things, whether I use the word faith, forgiveness, metanoia, they can take on religious significance if that's meaningful to someone who's religious, but they don't require that at all. But the notion in our verbiage of things that are outside of us, I think helps too. So like forgiveness is something that is done to me. It's almost like an act of grace by Source or something like that. You know, and self-forgiveness really is the kind of forgiveness from the other that we recognize in ourselves.
Right.
It's not like,
and
I forgive myself as my own act.
I think, don't forgive ourselves, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, God doesn't see sin. He automatically forgives us, sees us as perfect expressions of love. And so we're the only ones that play judge and executioner. And that's why I love you talking about self-control, asking the question. Jill, do you want to jump in? Do you have any thoughts on what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you answered the question, but why is it so hard to forgive ourselves? Why is that so difficult?
Well, I think it's really hard to forgive ourselves because we are the agency of whatever we perceived that we did wrong, and we're also relying upon the same guilty feeling faculties to forgive ourselves. So it's like we are the supposed problem trying to fix itself. It gets locked up in kind of a conundrum. You know, it's very hard to forgive ourselves with the very faculties that are feeling guilt-ridden. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I have a pattern. Gosh, what is it? Like, I think I'm addicted to the fact that there's something wrong with me. And
Take on that obsessive quality. Yeah, right. Yeah, I think everyone experiences that. Right, that's why we've got to get outside of ourselves, because when it comes to self-forgiveness, if I'm utilizing a kind of ego perspective in that, then I'm using guilt-ridden faculties to try and forgive the faculties that are, by definition, guilt-ridden. It's kind of a tautology or a circle. So that's where we've got to get out of ourselves, and that's the way to self-forgiveness, like I said, is really forgiveness by the other, whatever that may be to one, that is recognized by the self. The self isn't the agency of the forgiveness. The self is the one that recognizes the agency as other.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yeah, it is better.
Oh, good, good.
Yes.
Jill, do you have any
Thank
other
you.
Questions for Brent? I mean, we've gone past the hour mark, which is fine. As long as the discussion is scintillating, I keep the show going. And there have been so many different permutations on thinking that we could talk all night or till the end of time. But is there anything else that you'd like to ask Brent tonight? Because I'm going to have him back
again. You know, I do have another question. Like, I was raised that everything is about everyone else and never about me. How do I change that?
Again, we kind of went into this earlier, but it totally bears repeating. Is my sense ego. So the ego is not good or bad. The ego is and does have a necessary purpose. The sense that I am. Is most powerful and most what it is when it's in relationship, because it's always in relationship. And so the sense of selflessness that is detrimental to the ego is not altruism. Does that make sense? So the sense of self that one is most powerful when it's in relationship. So, but it's important, on the one hand, to have that sense of agency and self, that we do have a right to be me, that I'm free, that I have a general sense of safety, that I'm in touch, perhaps most importantly, with my calling and character and things like that, and to have that in relationship. Does that make sense?
Yes, and that was a great answer. Thank you.
Right, yeah, because what you're describing, and it sounds painful to me, is this kind of selflessness that is a pouring out of the ego at the expense of the self that I am, which is my ego. So if I'm continually, and, you know, this is, like, super important, not just for people in general, but, you know, therapists. And coaches and all of the people in the helping profession face this, where it's like my job is to give of myself, to be of service to people, but I have to know when is that. And again, you know, she points out some great gray areas. Again, I have to know when is that coming from genuine, authentic power and altruism, like I'm in a good space to be of service to others because I'm centered and I'm well. And then when is it too much? Like I'm pouring out everything of myself into a project or some challenges or a client or something to that effect, or just maybe in relationships, a friendship, a romantic relationship, a husband and wife, whatever, you know, then it becomes destructive because it's at the cost of me. Mm. And if there's an ethic in all of these things that we've talked about, it's kind of like that I have dignity and others have dignity in the way that we conduct ourselves, you know, so that it's not at a loss, like someone else somehow loses by some kind of interaction with me, or that somehow I lose something in an interaction, that as much as possible, and maybe it's kind of an ideal, that both people, it's reciprocal, that it goes back and forth without someone like sacrificing or losing something as a result of some interaction.
I'd like to
great
return
answer
to the end.
Thank you.
He's a wonderful guest. I'd like to return to the antithesis of something that you talked about earlier. We've talked about destructiveness. We've talked about trauma. Now, I would like to know where that comes from. If we are all born into this world as perfect expressions of for beingness, where do you think that comes from? It makes no sense to me. This dysfunction that's passed down throughout the eons from one generation to the other, the sins of the father being passed down to the sons or the daughters. If we are born into this world perfect, how do you think this began?
Well, I would want to differentiate what I'm talking about, like with the ACE studies, which is research, a certain kind of research, from kind of my thoughts on it. I'm more interested in depth psychology, and so I go back. So where does trauma come from? Why is there trauma might even be a better question. So the way that I tend to think about that, again, is from a metanoia perspective, or like a Greek perspective, really, where the challenges, which would include traumas, that come to us are a part of the unfolding of our character and fate and necessity and truth. If you go back into any mythology, it doesn't have to be Greek, and you look at what happens to the heroes, often those are very interesting sort of, we would call a lot of those things that happen to them trauma these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it becomes whether that trauma is in the service of further growth and a part of the unfolding of one's character, or is someone somehow fixed there and stuck there by the trauma? What strategies does someone employ to contend with trauma? And then does that process unfold?
I have a trick question for you.
Sure.
Do you believe in reincarnation?
That's something I don't talk about much in my writing, but personally I've been thinking more and more about lately, and I'm growing increasingly convinced that something like that is what's going on. Yeah. But that's
the reason
personal.
I bring it up.
I haven't written about that.
Yeah, the reason I bring it up, I'm aware of about a dozen past lives, some of them very significant. I'm not going to go there. Jill knows about it. But I had a very interesting experience. I was regressed by a multi-life therapist who was very talented, and she took me to a life where I'd been a prostitute. I had been raped by somebody viciously, shunned by my family and the village, left in shame and degradation, and then she rewrote history in that life. She took me back to the point prior to the rape, and I lived out a normal life. And what that did to me in this life was it released me from sexual addiction when she rewrote history. And so, you know, it makes me wonder if indeed there is such a thing as reincarnation, and I believe that to be true. It seems to me that the trauma can come from some other life or some other arena of which we're not aware. I don't know.
Well, I wouldn't be – I'm not expert on that. Like the person that you mentioned sounds like that's what, you know, they do as a profession. I'm not expert on that, but my quick sort of knee-jerk response in the area that I'm thinking around now is that, you know, the Greeks talked about eternal return or transmigration of soul. And so basically,
yeah.
From their perspective, of course, it's more complicated than this, but I'll just sketch it out as quickly as I can. It's like, you know, the unfoldment of character, it's kind of a literalism to assume that that has to happen in the space of this one existence here called Brent Potter in 2014. You know, this
right.
can be seen more, it's a matter of perspective. So the unfoldment of character or psyche or soul can be over quite a long time, is how they saw it. So basically, from their perspective, they would see the unfoldment of one's character as happening through the various challenges that arise and the way the person chooses to take them up or not take them up throughout the many different lives as the soul moves through different experiences and existences.
I like that very
much.
So,
yes, it would make sense to me from their perspective, you know, that, you know, the working out of one aspect of character in one existence would then work it out in another so that there would be reverberating effects as it moves through time.
Right.
It's
well,
like
I
an
think
ever
we'll try to wrap,
and then our life is like one chapter, you know.
Right. I think we'll try to wrap things up. We're coming up on the hour and a half mark. Jill, do you have any final questions or thoughts you'd like to put forward at this time?
Ashley, I do have another question real quick, if you don't mind.
Not at all. Please go ahead.
Okay. Some, you know, they're selfless, and we know what that is, but there are people that are self-motivated and self-serving. Can you explain what self-motivated is and self-serving is? And selfless, what's the difference?
Right. So I think that this actually goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where, you know, this sort of global way of looking at things where everything is a useful thing to me. To use your word, that would be kind of a narcissistic perspective. And so it's as if that possibility is kind of what is the hegemony of perspectives these days. What it's built entirely upon efficiency. It's built entirely upon usefulness. So anything and anyone that's encountered in life is seen as something that's useful, a useful object to me somehow. And so that, I think, is on a fundamental level, extremely selfish, and probably the basis of these things. Now, when you take that perspective, and then let's say, this is just one example, it's not the only one, that you add on a lot of stress developmentally. Let's say that there's a little bit of trauma throughout there. Trauma, one of its effects, not the only one, is it kind of causes the psyche, the mind, to recoil back upon itself. And so it becomes more self-focused because it's injured. Kind of the physical equivalent of that would be if, God forbid, I break my leg, I'd be pretty focused on the broken leg. I'm injured. It's that sort of phenomenon. And so I think that with the combination of the two, that's one possible outcome is a mind or a personality that's very focused on self and that's very egocentric. It's not the only outcome. And it's not the necessary outcome, but that is one way that I think that emerges. Does that answer
your question?
Well,
thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. No problem.
Thank you very much. This has been a wonderful discussion. I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Absolutely. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and I really appreciate you having me on. That was great. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I know Jill's pleasure, too. I can hear it in her voice. So I'm going to go out on a limb and speak for her. I really, really thank you. I'm glad that it worked out tonight. It was not meant to be the other day, and I did a solo show, and it was amazing. Some of the areas that I went.
I'm grateful for your patience and that we finally were able to connect on this. I do appreciate it.
Right. Well, thank you again, Brent. Thank you, Jill. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.